Hello and welcome to Volume 83 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about how to make sure you stay in compliance with the feds when you harvest in wet areas. We'll talk about what happens to you if you participate in cap and trade, and we'll get a reaction to a recent article in Barron's magazine that was bearish on timberland. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Well, it's rare that a forestry issue makes front page news, but that's what happened this summer when the U.S. House of Representatives passed the cap and trade bill. It's a forestry issue because what's being capped is carbon emissions, and trees are all about carbon. With us is Sven Brandt Erickson, who can offer his perspective. Welcome, Sven.
Good morning.
You recently wrote an article about how this bill would allow forest owners to sell emission offset credits. Can you explain how that's supposed to work?
Yes. The main parties regulated by a cap and trade program are things like refineries, power plants, but in order for them to comply, they're going to need to obtain allowances equal to tons of carbon for their emissions. And trees, of course, store carbon as well, store a couple of tons an acre in normal management per year. And forest owners can turn the storage of carbon on their lands into allowances through the program that's being created, and then sell that right, that carbon storage, as an offset to the emissions from power plants and refineries and such.
All right, if a forest owner wanted to do that, what kind of commitments would they be required to make in order to take part in the program?
Well, this is the thing that I think we have to watch most closely as this program is taking shape. California has been working on a carbon offset program now for several years. They're out ahead of the feds in setting up a carbon control program. And initially, they were asking for a permanent easement on the property that would restrict the way in which you use the property, lengthening your rotations or making other changes to increase your carbon storage. They've now dropped to 100 years commitment. The bill that just passed the House this summer does not contain a specific guideline for what would be required for forestry offsets to qualify for the program, but the expectation is that it could be a fairly long term. Now, there was a provision added at the end of the House debate for term offsets, which would be perhaps a 10 to 20 year commitment, which is much more in line with normal rotations, but it's not clear how that would actually play out. The details of that have to be worked out.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why folks from agriculture and forestry interests were very interested in having the Department of Agriculture instead of EPA run this program, the expectation being that Department of Agriculture would be more in tune with the expectations and desires of forest landowners and agriculture.
All right, other than these emission offset programs that you're describing, are there any other ways that the cap and trade program could affect forest owners?
Yes, you know, of course, other sectors of the economy are going to be affected by this program. In particular, refineries are going to be required to obtain emission allowances for the carbon content of the fuel they sell, which means, of course, they can't really reduce the amount of carbon in gasoline. They're going to have to buy allowances, and that's going to increase the price of fuel. And so any industry that is fuel dependent for its operations is going to see an increase in operating costs.
All right, Sven, thank you. Well, we appreciate you joining us.
All right, thank you.
We don't always realize it, but forestry operations in some wet areas would require a permit from the federal government. That is, if there weren't such a thing as the silvicultural exemption. Recently, the Alabama Forestry Commission wrote some recommendations to determine whether the silvicultural exemption should apply, and we're pleased to have the Alabama State Forester, Linda Casey, with us to help us understand that. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
What is the silvicultural exemption, and why is it important to landowners?
Well, in the Federal Clean Water Act, there's a provision called Section 404 that provides exemptions for what is considered normal silviculture activities that are part of some established or ongoing operation. And the reason that these exemptions are important to a landowner is because without them, they'd be required to get permits for certain silviculture activities like the construction of forest logging roads.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I understand the Forestry Commission was asked to write some recommendations to assist federal regulators when they look at this issue of ongoing operations. What was the reason or need for writing the report in the first place?
Well, in the past couple of years, there's been several controversial cases involving bottomland hardwood and cypress swamps, and they occurred when a field determination was made by either the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or EPA. They made a determination that was then subsequently challenged and overturned in court. The cases were quite different, but what it did was it outlined or identified a real need for some guidance document that these field representatives could use to help them in their decision making.
Okay.
And last October, at a Southern Group of State Foresters Water Quality Committee meeting, Tom Welburn, who is with EPA's Region 4, made a request to that committee that would we prepare a guidance document that would help assist field representatives in making an accurate assessment of whether bottomland, hardwood, or cypress swamps were indeed some kind of ongoing silviculture operation. In short, what he was looking for is something that would assist regulatory representatives who generally aren't very familiar with forestry operations.
Okay. What are some of the key points in the document landowners need to know?
Well, most landowners who have bottomland hardwood or cypress swamps, they're very much aware that most of the time you leave them alone to grow and develop, so that there's going to be long periods of time where there's not a lot of silvicultural activity going on. But because of this, these periods that where you've got a lot of time that goes by and not very many activities occurring, it's extremely important for landowners to have a forest management plan. And then some examples of what might be in that plan or activities that a landowner might be able to point out would be things like what are your plans for timber harvesting and reforestation? A really good one is does your forest, do you have it enrolled in a third-party certification program? And many landowners are generally doing some type of forest management activity. It may be something as simple as doing boundary line maintenance or fire break construction, insect disease control, or many other types of timber stand improvement activities.
All right.
But the most important thing that a landowner would really need to have is that management plan.
All right. Well, thank you, Linda. We appreciate you offering those thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professional foresters first receive training in accredited forestry schools across the nation, and every forester at one time has attended a class in forest management and has studied carefully the required textbook. We have the primary author of such a textbook, Dr. Pete Bettinger from the University of Georgia, with us to tell us how these type textbooks can be a valuable part of your library. Hello, Dr. Bettinger.
Hello.
What motivated the development of this particular book on forest management and planning?
Well, first, let me thank you for inviting me to take part in this panel.
Mm-hmm.
And to address your question, myself and three other authors from around the country have taught forest management, planning, and economics types courses for a number of years now. And what we've noticed over the last few years was that some of the better forest management books were getting quite dated, and some of the more recently published books had become a little too complex for our undergraduate students. For example, through some conversations with other colleagues, we found that one of the most widely used forest management books, which was published in 2001, and one that I was also a co-author on, was only partly used in our university-level forest management classes. Therefore, we thought a more concise and direct approach for teaching forest management and planning concepts was needed, and an approach that also explicitly covered the main topics that we found in most of the curriculum of the courses taught in North American universities.
Okay. Well, I can see how it would help a student, but how would a book like this assist just private land managers or foresters in developing their own plans?
Okay, good question. Our book provides a number of things that might be of value to forest landowners. One is simply an insight into the history of forest planning in North America. Another is an overview of the planning and decision-making processes that are typically used in forest management organizations. We also provide a number of succinct examples on how economic valuation can be used to assess alternatives. We provide a background on the typical forest metrics that are collected or computed using field data, and then an overview of a number of emerging issues such as certification, forest sustainability, and the several philosophies around that issue, carbon sequestration, and also supply chain management.
Well, all of those seem like very practical topics that could help foresters and land managers. Dr. Bettinger, we appreciate you joining us. Thank you for sharing about that.
Thank you very much.
Brooks Mendel has been a guest on Capital Ideas Live on two other occasions, speaking on the timber markets, but today we wanted to invite him to share his thoughts on how to effectively use forestry professionals and also how to develop an interview guide. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Hayes.
You mentioned an interview guide in the past, and I wanted to get you to tell us how such a guide could help a landowner identify qualified professionals.
Thanks. Yeah, the key with an interview guide is that we've all been in situations before where we're talking to a series of people over time, or we have a situation where we go, man, I wish I'd asked that question. An interview guide is simply a way to get those questions down in advance, because by the time you talk to someone after your first cup of coffee in the morning and the final question at the end of the day, you want to, number one, make sure you've asked everybody you're looking at, whether it's an accountant, a lawyer, or a logger, the same questions. You want to be able to have a means for comparing them, so now you have notes where you can compare them head-to-head, and it protects you as well. So in the future, when you finally decide to hire somebody, you'll be able to document and say, well, when we had talked about it originally, this is what our understanding was. This seems to be a little bit different. And so an interview guide can be a very powerful tool.
I've heard you speak on some real practical tips for checking references before. Why don't you talk about that a minute?
Sure. References are a big deal. You know, I've always said, and my dad always told me, if you're going to ask for them, check them, because that's really the power of a reference. It's not the threat of checking them. It's actually checking them. And one way we found that's really effective is that if, for example, I wanted to hire Hayes Brown and you provided me with a set of references, one thing I might do is call some of the references after hours and leave the following message on their phone. I'm thinking about hiring Hayes. If you really can recommend Hayes, please call me back. And if people don't call you back, it tells you something. If you do this with one person and they don't call you back, it may or may not mean something because they don't know who you are. But if you call three or four people and leave that same message and nobody calls you back, there's a red flag there and something to follow up on.
And I've already told my mother to always return that call. So.
That's right.
Once you've retained a forestry professional, how do you get what you pay for?
Sure. You know, at the end of the day, you really show what's important by how you spend your time. And Ronald Reagan always had an expression, trust and verify. There's another expression, it's trust in Allah, but tie your camel. So in forestry, that's a really big deal because even if we're hiring somebody who's in a field that we don't have a lot of direct experience, simply by showing up to take a look, especially on our own land and our own forest, we're letting the person that we're working with, that professional we retain, we're letting them know that this is an important job and it results in better performance. Research shows that work that is supervised or checked on gets better results. The other thing we do when we're there is ask questions and make sure you get answers. That's two different things. Asking a question, making sure you get an answer that you understand are two different things.
All right, makes sense. Thank you, Brooks. Appreciate you joining us. Oftentimes, landowners will need to receive or may be asked to give a temporary easement for forestry purposes. We wanted to check in with Robert Jackson, an attorney from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, who has a wealth of experience in preparing these type documents. Welcome, Robert.
Well, good morning. I'm happy to be on the program, too.
Do easements really have to be in writing, or can I just talk to someone and grant them that right orally?
No, they really need to be in writing. The statute of frauds states that any interest in real estate must be in writing to be enforceable, and granting an easement would be an interest in real estate. So it really must be in writing to protect actually both parties, grantor and grantee.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we do take your advice and put it in writing, does this document need to be recorded like deeds have to be recorded at the courthouse?
Yes, I would always record them. It provides notice to the public that the easement is there. Recording it really protects the grantee because that right is there. And, you know, some issues could come up, even though I've said in the easement that the successors in interest, the heirs, executors, administrators, and assigns are included. Even though I've said that, there might be an issue if a landowner granted an easement and sold the property and it wasn't recorded,
mm-hmm.
because the buyer would not have noticed that the easement was there.
But if it were recorded, they would. Then.
Yeah, if it was recorded, mm-hmm. that they would. And then there might be an issue if someone granted the easement and perished the thought died and it was not recorded. There might be an issue there, too.
What are some of the items that you see typically in these type easements and provisions that you recommend?
Well, there must be a lot of agreed terms because there are things that could happen. First of all, we need to provide a termination, a way to terminate it. Maybe it's a date. Maybe it's by agreement. The grantor needs to control that. If the grantee of the easement should breach the terms, then the grantor needs the ability to terminate it immediately. We need to provide for damages to the property that the grantee might cause. We want the grantee to be responsible for all damages, but we might require a damage deposit and return it if everything is repaired. We don't want damage to roads and certainly don't want damage to trees. We need to make sure the grantee has insurance, liability insurance, and we want the grantee to hold the landowner harmless from any and all lawsuits or damages where the landowner may get sued for damages caused by the grantee. And then we also we want the landowner's attorney's fees and court costs to be paid. We want there to be a prohibition against transfer of the easement. We don't want the easement transferred to anyone that the landowner does not approve. And we want the easement to be for a specific purpose, like the harvesting of timber.
Okay. Well, all those thoughts, I think, are included in your temporary easement, which we'll post next to your image on the website. Robert, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
For most tax professionals, job one is making sure your client pays exactly the right amount of taxes. You won't be able to do this if you don't know where the starting line is. And the starting line is basis. And it's not sexy, it's no fun, but it's vital. Tammy Cushing can explain. Hello, Tammy.
Good morning, Hayes.
Remind us again, what is basis?
Well, to put it real simple, basis is really what you have in the asset. So if you've acquired the forest land by purchase, what we need to do from the beginning is allocate some of that purchase price between the value of the land and the trees that were standing there when we bought them. So what we're going to do is basically just keep account of how much of that purchase price we believe and that we can document is attributable to those standing trees. And so it's just a way of us capturing that amount, and we're going to use that later on through the life of the stand.
Well, tell us about how to use it. Why is this having it important to someone who has to pay taxes?
Well, the absolute most important time for you to know when that basis is when you're cutting. When you go to cut those trees, you're going to take a gain on that in most cases. I can't imagine too many reasons why you're not going to, but what we want to do is reduce that gain. We don't want you to pay any more on that than is required by law, and the law allows for you to deduct that basis from your gain, and then you would only pay tax on the difference between your basis and the amount that you actually received.
Okay, and also maybe when you sell the property?
When you sell the property, we also have that issue.
Sure,
yeah.
Good. What happens if you just don't have a clue where to start? You don't have a basis established. Where do you go?
Well, that's really what has triggered this whole conversation is there's been a lot of landowners who are going, oops, I'm cutting my timber, and what's basis? And I don't have one. And so there is a method that we can use to back up into the basis that should have been established when the purchase occurred or if it was inherited. And basically it's something where you're going to have to involve some professionals. You need to know the timber prices that were in place when you purchased or acquired the property. And we're also going to have to back up the volume from the volume we have today. So you would need to know a current inventory and then be able to back that inventory up to what standing timber you would have had at that point in time.
I might need a professional to help you with that.
It's best to have a professional who's done that before.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Tammy. Appreciate you reinforcing that idea for everyone.
Thank you.
Well, it's August, and it's getting closer to deer season, and it's about time to plant food plots. This is a great time to ask ourselves some fundamental questions about food plots. And Craig Harper has the answers. Welcome, Craig.
Good morning, Hayes.
Just remind us again, why do landowners plant food plots?
Primarily, landowners plant food plots for two reasons. Most of the folks want something out there that will help them with hunting and viewing opportunities. And there's also a number of folks that plant food plots to increase the nutritional carrying capacity, provide additional nutrition to wildlife. And as you mentioned, white-tailed deer, without any question, white-tailed deer enthusiasts plant far more food plots than all the others combined. A close second then after that would be those for mourning doves, and primarily folks who are planting plots for mourning doves are for really the opening weekend of dove season, but also throughout the dove season. Then quail enthusiasts often plant some strips for bobwhites, primarily to have some increased nutrition through the winter. And then there's other species that folks plant food plots for as well, but the lion's share of them are for deer hunting.
Are there any guidelines on how many acres should be planted in a food plot?
As you open up a hunting magazine, you'll probably be hard-pressed to find one that doesn't include something about food plots, and you will often see someone recommend that you need to plant anywhere from 1 to 5% of your acreage in food plots. While that might be a ballpark figure, it really varies greatly. It varies greatly with habitat quality. It varies with your objectives. And it varies with deer density, whether you are planting for deer or not. If you have so many deer that you can't plant food plots, obviously you have a problem. If you are planting food plots specifically for deer and you have so many deer that your food plots can't grow, then obviously you need to implement additional habitat management practices, of which planting food plots could be one of those. And you also need to lower the deer density. Too many properties try to carry more deer than what they should. If you're on a property that is surrounded by cropped soybeans and corn and wheat on rotation, obviously food availability during certain times of the year are less of a concern for you than someone who lives in an area that is primarily mature forest.
How important are these food plots to reach the goals of seeing and harvesting game animals?
That's a good question. A lot of that has to do with perception. So many hunters perceive that they have to have a food plot in order to kill something, and that is just not the case. In fact, studies have shown that those who use food plots do not, on a regular basis, kill more animals than do those that do not hunt with food plots. And that could be a little biased because, like I said earlier, a lot of the folks who plant food plots aren't doing it just to kill or harvest some animal, but they truly have the interest of the animal at heart, and they're trying to provide additional nutrition, and that is really good. However, if their goal is to harvest more animals, they might be surprised that may not help them more than what they might think, because people don't typically hunt around food plots very smartly. The other thing is, in terms of their nutritional goals, if they're planting food plots just to increase or primarily to increase nutrition for wildlife, they have to be sure that they're implementing a food plot plan. Just going out and planting one food plot usually does not increase the nutritional carrying capacity of a property. You have to study and look and figure out when is the low nutritional time on your property, when is food a limiting factor, and that is when the food really should be available through food plots.
And that's often after hunting season.
It absolutely. Oftentimes during late summer and during late winter. Those are really the two primary stress periods for wildlife, and it has nothing to do with the hunting season. That's exactly right.
Okay, thank you, Craig. Appreciate you joining us. A recent article in Barron's Magazine by Andrew Berry has the owners of REITs talking. Berry concludes that timber is an overhyped investment. He advises those looking for commodity investments and an inflation hedge to look elsewhere. In our markets chair is Denise Davis, who's read the article closely, and we invited her to comment. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You took issue with this recent article in Barron's. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think Andrew Berry is overhyped. It is, in my opinion, it's not a serious article. It's data light. It has a very short-term perspective. I think if one is a trader, perhaps it's useful if you're going to look at short-term move in various REIT prices. For example, he quotes Plum Creek. However, for a serious investor and for the investors that I advise, we take a longer-term perspective, and there's no doubt if you go back even to 1934 and you can run any mix of timber in asset portfolios, you, by and large, are going to get a higher level of return by holding timber in certain percentages. And now it varies. It can be, some data has suggested 10% of a portfolio. Some have gone up to 30%, but the important point is, regardless, that it increases return and it reduces risk of an overall portfolio. And I think in particular, it's interesting because he undermines his own article in the opening paragraph because he cites the fact that the S&P 500 has corrected, or the general broad market has corrected in the last couple of years, whereas timber prices have gone up. But that's exactly what you want to have happen with a timber holding, because it has low to negative correlation with asset classes. And when you are a serious investor, this is what's important.
And you've mentioned it being you've mentioned it being a smaller part of a portfolio because of diversification. How does the diversification add value?
The diversification adds value because, for example, with any asset class, if you just held, let's just take gold as an example. If you just held gold, you would be subject to just one asset class boom or bust. If you hold a diversified portfolio, what happens is you are allowing the parts of your portfolio to outperform the market while the other parts of the portfolio stay more muted, but the inverse is true. So when those asset classes, let's say gold is out of favor and, you know, some other asset class, large cap value, is taking a big run or large cap growth, if you have a mixed portfolio that's well diversified, what it does is it reduces your overall risk and it gives you the highest ability to capture the upside.
Just briefly, how did you get involved?
It sounds esoteric, but it works.
Well, it does. I'm sure it does. And just briefly, how did you get involved in timberland as an investment?
Well, it's interesting because I was looking for ways, while I think that the overall economy and the market is going to stay relatively muted and I'm not worried about inflation over the near term or even perhaps the next couple of years, I am worried about it, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. And given that, I started looking around for different asset classes to hedge my clients. And one of the highest correlation asset classes with inflation is timber. And I thought, based on that, that it behooved me to dig deeper, do more research, and my conviction lies with holding some timber assets. And
sure.
The Barron's article scared my investors, as well as I am sure it worried some of the landowners out
right.
there.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Denise. We appreciate it very much. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Sven Brandt Erickson, Linda Casey, Pete Bettinger, and Brooks Mandel. And we also appreciate the contributions of Robert Jackson, Tammy Cushing, Craig Harper, and Denise Davis. Forests are interpreted in many ways by different people. One person sees a scary and forbidding place, while another sees a lovely ecological playground. Another may see a mini factory which runs 24/7 while the owner's away. In bottomland hardwood forests, federal regulators are called upon to determine whether this really is a working forest. In low-lying areas, which are not harvested very frequently, inaction may look like it's not a working forest. And that's why it's good that the Alabama Forestry Commission has been asked to explain what forest management looks like in these areas. So hats off to the Alabama Forestry Commission for their work. And on behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.